Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time air conditioning seeker.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that wheels movie tickets as if they were passports to distant countries, which, of course, they are, if only virtually. Our most recent on-screen travels took us to three different countries, the first being England, setting of the time travel mystery trip titled Rose of Nevada. We also toured a couple of spots in Iceland, setting of the family drama The Love That Remains. And finally, we learned all about the history of what is now the Croatian city of Rijeka in the historical documentary titled Fiume o Morte. Let's begin on the shores of England's southwestern coast. That location is the English county of Cornwall, which is where Rose of Nevada, a film written and directed by Mark Jenkins and starring George MacKay and Colm Turner, is set. The title refers to a fishing boat that has seen better days, its rusty mechanisms looking as if they haven't been serviced in a decade or three. That might provide a clue as to what is going on, because writer-director Jenkins isn't interested in explaining anything, not in any detail anyway. Let's just say that MacKay and Turner, who in one unfolding plotline, play respectively Nick and Liam. But then when each is hired to head out on the Rose of Nevada for what is supposed to be a couple of days fishing, they return to a world and a life that is far different from the one they left. How and why this happens is what Jenkins offers us as a plotline, though as I say, he gives us clues but never fully explains anything. So what we're left with is a film shot in a film ratio that resembles old school home movies, and a lot of acting by MacKay in particular that has him appearing as befuddled as the rest of us. Rose of Nevada is an interesting film experiment, but it's not likely to satisfy those who prefer narrative substance over style steeped in mysterious imagery.
Dan, I think you addressed this or introduced this properly by mentioning that it's a time travel film, but we don't get that sense immediately. We know something's a little bit awry. And so The Rose of Nevada has nothing to do with roses or Nevada, rather, name of a boat. But when it pulls back into port, as you indicated, it's all like rusty and everything. But people are surprised to see that boat in the harbor. And so we see a guy come down and basically ask his wife, hey, should we take this up again? Should we send it out? And she agrees. So they put together this crew. And I recognized, I think people will recognize both of the actors. I think that maybe Colm Turner is the more notable one since he married Dua Lipa this summer and got a lot of publicity for that. But he was in The Boys in the Boat. And George MacKay is recognizable from his star turn in 1917, for example. And it is the performances that I thought made this work, because I was a little confused initially, because it seems as though we're shifting time frames. And Nick, our protagonist whose roof has just fallen in, who has a small daughter and wife, you know, is not really a fisherman, hired on as a deckhand. And he seems more puzzled by the things that are happening to him than his cohort, played by Colm Turner. But we gradually start to figure out maybe what's happening. We're not exactly sure why. And Jenkins leaves that open for interpretation. But it's sort of the relationships among the different people at these different time points that I thought made the film pop for me.
Yeah, and Mark Jenkins, I'm a fan of his, and I really liked this movie, Rose of Nevada. And his movies are primarily about textures, I guess, are the best way to describe it. I mean, it's all about how the places in his movies look and feel, and also how the film itself, the celluloid, looks and feels, because he shoots on 16 millimeter, so it's super grainy. He's often filming with unsynchronized sound. And so the effect is that these movies look like artifacts, like something that he's unearthed, like a transmission from another time. And it's the case in Rose of Nevada of that style lining up perfectly with the themes of the story. And as you mentioned, Cornwall, this small town, is in all of Jenkins' movies. He lives there. He shoots his film there, including his previous features, Bait and Ennis Man. That's E-N-Y-S, Men. And he often uses the same actors, including his partner, Mary Woodvine, who has a co-writing credit on Rose of Nevada. And watching his movies, I'm reminded of British working-class filmmakers like Ken Loach or Mike Lee, and that Jenkin really understands this community. He understands what it's like to be a fisherman whose livelihood is dependent on how much they catch in a given day. But then there's also this thread of folk horror running through it. And a lot of his movies, especially these last two, Rose of Nevada included, really remind me of something like The Wicker Man or Picnic at Hanging Rock, where there's just this dread that you feel all the way through it. And sometimes nothing really happens, but you really get the sense that something is wrong, something is up, and you walk away from this movie not having any concrete answers, as you mentioned. But I want to go back to that word texture. I think that's what this is all about. I just really liked being absorbed in the spell of this movie.
Well, and it's a contrast. I think it's okay to say that, an original incident happened in 1993. And so now we're going to fast forward at different points to more of the present. And we see the contrast between life in this town in an earlier point and now in the present, where obviously it's dependent on the fishing industry more or less, but things have changed. It also taught me yet again how hard this fishing gig is. I mean, the three of us had seen a documentary titled Buck's Harbor at the SIFF Film Festival, and it was a documentary about fishermen in present-day Maine. It is backbreaking work. You're totally at the mercy of the elements and these smelly fish that are traveling with you for days on end and so forth. I thought Jenkin did a great job of capturing those images. Sometimes they're very clear, and as you point out, other times they're almost like scratchy and we're dealing with the different time frames and so forth.
Or the film gets overexposed, and so there's this kind of, yellowish red tint that comes over it. And
right, like
I
an
love
old
all of that.
Photo that you had taken, and then we find out, so these photos come into play, and the different characters, we see them in various incarnations between the two time periods, which was also very intriguing to me.
I'm glad that you brought a Picnic at Hanging Rock, Nathan, because that remains one of my favorite films. I saw it when it first came out in the 70s, and it was one of those movies that you immediately had to go and see again because you thought, what happened here? What,
And on a second viewing, you might understand even less.
Exactly.
The first,
but it also reminded me of Michelangelo Antonioni's La Ventura, where a third of the way through, or maybe halfway through, a character disappears. Everybody looks for that person, and then they just go on with their lives, and it's never mentioned again. So I think that it was maybe because I was so steeped in those movies, those classic films, that I wasn't all that impressed with the storyline here, because I thought I'd seen this before. And it felt like even a Twilight Zone episode, So I didn't think that the story offered me anything new. But as Rose of Nevada carried on, as it progressed, I was taken with exactly what he puts on the screen.
Well, and I think Jenkin was practically a one-man band here, because you mentioned a co-writer, certainly, but he also, is a cinematographer and the editor and does the post-production sound stuff. And I think that that's pretty notable, because he's a relatively new filmmaker.
Even though his movies look like they're very old, like they have been, taken out of a box like an old picture. I think there is more going on in Rose of Nevada in terms of its themes than maybe it lets on originally. There's this recurring image of a crack in a ceiling, which you sort of alluded to earlier, MP. And that crack eventually becomes a giant hole in this roof. And one of the characters literally falls through it. And we see that image more than once. And I think that's a fitting image, because that's sort of what happens to the characters, metaphorically and literally. And I think ultimately this kind of time loop that happens, and it's become such an exhaustive narrative trope, the time loop. I think that as they're falling into it, it starts to say something about the predicament of the working class, the predicament of these towns that are dependent on a single industry, and what can happen when those loops don't come back around again. So it left me thinking with a lot of stuff. It's just done in a very non-traditional way that seems puzzling at first, but it became a little clear to me as I got further away from it.
That was our discussion of Rose of Nevada. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to talk about Iceland's The Love That Remains and the Croatian documentary Fiume o Morte. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
You've already discovered that Spokane Public Radio is an excellent source of news and entertainment. But did you know that this station is a nonprofit? Public Radio is for the public, available to all, free of charge. That's possible thanks to people, just like you, who give what they can to support open access to information. So thank you for listening and for making all of this possible.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the English mystery Rose of Nevada. We're going to continue our virtual international trek by heading first to Iceland for the family drama The Love That Remains, and then Croatia for the documentary Fiume o Morte. Many, many movies have been made about divorce and the effects both on the parents and the children who get caught in the middle. Few, though, do so with such an offbeat sense of narrative sensibility that Icelandic writer-director Hilmar Pálmason puts into his film The Love That Remains. For one thing, he provides virtually no exposition, so we're forced simply to try to keep up as we watch an extended family deal with their everyday lives. Only slowly do we come to realize that the parents in question, Anna and Magnus, are separated, still have affection for one another, but definitely aren't getting back together. Pálmason might have given us a film similar to, say, the American films Kramer vs. Kramer or Shoot the Moon, but he follows no real storyline and fills the frames with shots that tend to break the fourth wall, inviting us to be as much a part of what's going on as the actors playing characters themselves.
Well, I really love this movie, and I really love the way that Pálmason makes movies. He also made a film from a few years ago called Godland, another one called A White, White Day, which was one of my favorite films of 2019, and seek that out if you haven't seen it or
was that the one about the old man missing his wife?
Yeah, his wife passes away and then he realizes that she's been carrying on an affair and he doesn't know what to do with it.
And isn't that actor, he has a
he's the grandfather in The Love That Remains. Yes. So yeah, he's using a lot of the same actors. But I just love his visual sense. I mean, he has all these meditative shots of nature. That's a running theme in his films. And the nature tends to reflect what's happening to the characters. But he also lets his stories wander. And sometimes they wander into really unexpected and I think kind of unsettling places, even though sometimes you're laughing as they're going into these unsettling places. And I think it's fitting that we're pairing this, The Love That Remains, with Rose of Nevada, because both of these movies kind of pull you in with the details of its characters' lives. And then it reveals that there's something very strange going on under the surface because, as you suggested, there are images in this movie that I think are manifestations of the characters' dreams and their desires and their fears. I mean, there's this really bizarre interlude with this art curator that comes to town. He has to fly in on this, single-engine
guy,
plane.
Yeah.
And he's just a total bore. And then what ultimately happens to him is kind of like the first break in the movie's reality. Then there's the whole business involving the husband and the family rooster and how he takes his anger out on the rooster and then the rooster gets its revenge. And I don't want to spoil anything, but it is one of the most bizarre, out of nowhere scenes that I can recall in recent movies. So yeah, this movie is not at all what you think it's going to be. It's all the seasons in these people's lives. But there's so much more going on. And I was just delighted all the way through. But I want to use that word unsettling again, because even though there's warmth in this movie, there's humor in it, there's just this nagging feeling that something isn't right and something bad is going to happen. And I just found this such a thrilling, unexpected movie.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned two movies, Dan, about family relationships. And I thought of the Noah Baumbach films, including Marriage Story, and the sort of dissolving or familial relationships and the impact on kids and so forth. But there are things throughout this movie, and you never know, should I take this in The Love That Remains as symbolic or metaphorical.
Or literal,
right,
in some
exactly.
cases.
And we don't, I mean, for example, the mom, the wife, or erstwhile wife in this particular film, is an artist, like a large-scale artist. And she makes these designs that were simultaneously fascinating and befuddling.
And she lets the elements help her with
right.
the
and
art.
So that's yeah. sort of the metaphorical mm-hmm. part. So she makes these designs out of steel that then rust out and leave an impression, almost like a woodcut. And they're very dramatic. And so I think that's a statement. And that's what the Swedish fellow comes to see or observe or look at or whatever. And then the kids are building this sort of structure, this human-like structure out on a point, and you're trying to figure out, is this, you know, does this have some purpose? It's like an ice scarecrow. But
it devolves, and is this like the de-evolution of the marriage?
It's, right, you know, right. Or is this, are there the feelings toward their dad, or you don't really know. But then, because these people are co-parenting, sometimes they spend time together, and you think, are they really not going to get back together? And the final thing I would say is the landscape of Iceland really looks beautiful here. It was filmed in terms of the change of seasons and so forth, and that's what sticks with me, the visual images from this movie.
Yeah. And that ends our discussion about the Icelandic drama, The Love That Remains. Let's now turn to a documentary that explores an incident that occurred just after the close of the First World War. The documentary is titled Fiume o Morte, which is Italian for fiume or death. Fiume is both the Italian word for river and is the name of a town on the northeastern shore of the Adriatic Sea, or anyway, was the name of the town back in the years following World War I, when for 15 months it was the independent city-state known as the Free State of Fiume. Because of its deep water port, the town was targeted by several countries, and during what was an international standoff, an arch-Italian patriot named Gabriele D'Annunzio paraded in, proclaimed the town as the Italian Regency of Carnara, and proclaimed himself as its leader, or Il Duce, until the Italian government ended up invading and, after a short bloody struggle, ousted him. Croatian filmmaker Igor Berzinovich tells the story of how D'Annunzio, a noted Italian poet and politician, took charge in an unusual and sometimes humorous manner. Berzinovich casts various actors as the man, and then he reenacts what happened by having them walk through the streets under the gaze of today's residents of the town, now called Rijeka, many of whom have no idea who D'Annunzio was. The result is an original stab at capturing a bit of the past that would otherwise be little more than a historical footnote.
This approach to filmmaking, casting these unknown local actors, it's not necessarily a new one. I mean, I'm thinking most recently of Oppenheimer's The Act of Killing that took place in Indonesia, or there was the Don't Care If We Go Down in History as Barbarians, and the one about Paris, La Commune, Paris, 1871. So casting local actors is not new. But what was new about the way the director handles the local actors here is the fact that he casts several actors to play D'Annunzio, and each of them sort of bring out a different part of who this guy might have been, who play him as more gentle. We have him played as, you know, more of a tyrant. We have him play as more of a poet. And so I found that to be very intriguing. And of course, this whole history of border towns that shifted allegiances over time. I mean, we know that happened throughout the Austro-Hungarian Empire, for example, and the Ottoman Empire and so forth. forth. And I really did appreciate the way that he sort of seamlessly goes back and forth between this archival footage and the modern footage. Sometimes he shifts it or he compares these two scenes side by side in black and white, in color. He mixes them up. At one point, I remember he shoots our modern actors in this sort of traditional way, but they're all looking at their cell phones.
Yeah.
There are really quirky things about this film that I just appreciated a lot.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned The Act of Killing, because if you hadn't, I would have. And its companion film, The Look of Silence. I was also reminded of the documentaries of Agnes Varda, especially her movies about how time changes people and places and the juxtaposition of eras. And it seems like it might be kind of an easy joke. I mean, that image you mentioned, that's kind of like the signature kind of image of the movie. But I think what he's doing here is he's showing that absurdism, but he's also reminding us of how close we still are to that history, regardless of how many people still remember it or maybe never knew about it in the first place. So yeah, I found this really funny and haunting and fascinating.
I have to say, I really did like Fiume Old Morte because it wasn't anything like what I expected to see. And when something like that comes upon you and you recognize the humor, you guys are both reminding me about how funny it was at certain points, particularly when they're parading through town and people are looking at them with their gelato in their hand going, who is this? What's going on here? You know, it's...
Well,
shades
and apparently
of the death
they
of
had
Stalin
all of
too.
These photos from that time period. But then when they actually go to vote, that sort of passes quickly because things are not necessarily going to turn out as some people hoped or intended. But Dan, as you mentioned up front, a lot of modern day people know nothing about this era of their own history.
That's right.
And many Italians wouldn't know anything about D'Annunzio except for his contribution to literature.
That's right. And that was our look at the Croatian documentary Fiume o Morte. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed the English film Rose of Nevada and the Icelandic drama The Love That Remains. Let's take this moment to thank Aaron Weir for directing the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners, as always. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from the Catholic theologian St. Augustine. The world is a book, and those who do not travel read only one page. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.